Welcome to Trust in Tech, where we have conversations with people helping the internet and society thrive. I'm Alice Huntsberger. In today's episode, I talk to four Integrity Institute members who are part of the Elections Best Practices Working Group. That's Glenn Ellingson, Swapnil Mehta, Diane Chang, and Eric Davis. The group released their second best practices guide last month. My apologies for taking a few weeks to get this podcast together. And in that report, they outline ways that platforms can both define and achieve election integrity success. The guide covers a ton of material, but that includes topics of working with external stakeholders, the role that generative AI plays in election integrity issues, and an abusive actor taxonomy. And we're going to go over some of these topics in the podcast today. This project was the result of many months of work for over a dozen people, so I really recommend you check it out. You can find it at integrityinstitute.org under the research tab, and then go to the election integrity program. I'd also like to add our usual disclaimer that the opinions stated on this show are from the individuals themselves and they aren't representative of their employers. Thank you for listening. We're going to get to the interviews. And again, it's going to be a chat with four different people. This is a new format. So if you like these short mini interviews on one topic, then let me know what you think and maybe we'll do more of them. Our first guest is Glenn Ellingson, who's one of the lead authors of this project, along with Katie Harbath. If you want to hear more from Glenn and also from Katie, we did a podcast with them on the first election integrity guide back in May. So you can go check that out if you're interested. But let's hear from Glenn now on the most recent election guide.
First of all, really delighted to have a chance to talk to you and to share this kind of stuff that we've been working on here. My name is Glenn Ellingson, and I have been working on internet platforms of one type or another, basically for coming on 30 years, since there sort of was a thing we could call an internet to have platforms. Over time, I worked on a bunch of platforms and came to working on like large e-commerce platforms. For a short while, went and dived into politics to try and think about, like, you know, how can we get great thought leadership around, you know, big global problems. And I realized it really comes back to humans talking to each other. So back in 2019, I joined Meta, Facebook at the time's civic integrity team. So I worked there for 3 years, including through things like the U.S. Election of 2020. Through many other global elections, through the pandemic and all that came with that. For me, what was important all the way through was really this view of how can we just make this stuff better, right? Like, I'm not actually a social media fan. I don't enjoy the products that much, but I know that's where we are. That's where how the world talks to each other nowadays. So I'm like, okay, how do we, since this is where we're talking, how we're talking, how do we make it work for people? How do we think both about the immediate dangerous things that happen, like false information that can get people killed, frankly, like, you know, in the worst case scenarios, through violence or just through inaccurate information that can cause a panic or could prevent people from knowing how to safely conduct themselves in a serious actual problem, like, let's say, the COVID pandemic. But then also, like, what are the second order effects of like how these platforms work and how they shape what we see and hear and the information environment that we all live in. So that's what I was doing for a while. I left Meta 2 years ago and said, really, how can I contribute along with other people to making all of our interactions better, not just the ones that happen on Meta's platforms? And I joined the Integrity Institute. And the Integrity Institute is a whole bunch of us who have done this sort of thing. We've said, like, how do we make platforms better? How do we make them less bad? Which are kind of two sides of the coin. And we'll probably talk about that a little more. But, how can we help each other as integrity professionals understand how to do that well? Some of that's sharing best practices. Here's what we did. Here's what we learned. It was what we thought. It wasn't what we thought. Here's the parts of it that were really unexpected that you should think about on your way in, because otherwise you'll be thinking about them under a lot of time pressure in the middle of an election event, right? So, but also not only to share with each other, but also to try and help other people who haven't done this work before and aren't planning to do this work sort of understand what it's like. What are we facing? What are the real challenges here, right? and see if we can be more open about what we're doing, see if we can help policymakers know what could help or hinder, as I think very legitimately, lots of stakeholders and actors outside these companies have very important positions vis-a-vis this sort of thing and should be applying pressure outside into these companies. So how to do that? So hopefully helping the people doing the work, helping the companies to understand the importance of the work, helping people outside to be able to put pressure on the companies to do a better job, all of the above. So that's why we did what we did.
And then you have a specific timeline with this work as well. So can you talk a little bit about why this period in time is when you released the selection report and how long it took you and how far ahead you had to plan knowing you were going to release it, you know, towards the end of 2023 and in anticipation of 2024? Because I know that was deliberate.
It was deliberate, actually. Partly, I think, we inside the Institute, we're doing some things already around the 2022 election in the US and other sort of elections. I don't know. I mean, it's clearly different every place in the globe, but there's a concentration in even numbered years where it seems like there's more elections, as well as the fact that the biggest elections in some of the largest countries, including very notably the US, tend to always be in the even years, right? So we were dealing with the 2022 election cycle and trying to provide some support mechanisms across the industry to people who are working on the US and Brazilian election cycles in the second part of 2022. And as we were trying to take a little bit of a breath from that, we're like, well, that was fun. And we feel like we helped some people, but how should we take these lessons and make them useful to people in the next cycle? How do we consolidate that, share it wider, be more helpful, help the industry raise its game? And then we looked ahead and we said, it didn't take us very long to figure out, like, so that was 2022. What does 2024 look like? And the first thing we said is, oh my God, the US is going to be even more. And then we started looking at the rest of the world as well and said, oh my God, the whole rest of the world is going to be huge. There's an incredible number of elections, billions of humans are going to be casting a ballot in 2024 globally. So we said, that's the time frame that we really want to be able, that's the next big cycle. That's probably when a lot of thought is going to go into this and a lot of companies that maybe haven't done this before, that maybe weren't as big and weren't as active in this cycle, are going to really need to face these questions and do this sort of work in 2024. So we actually started a full year ago and said, and a group of us have been working inside the Institute. I would say somewhere between 20 and 30 of us at different times over the last year have been working at putting out the sort of the two-piece guides. The first one came out about 5 months ago and the second one just recently. And we really wanted to both take the time to really make these deep enough to be useful to people, but we also wanted to get them out because one of the first lessons from our first guide was, hey, this is not something you can do on the fly while people are voting. This is something that for each election that, you want to make sure you can responsibly support, you got to look at what the structural shape of that election is going to be. You need to think about what your company's or platform's sort of environment is vis-a-vis that country. You got to figure out what are the scariest things? What are the biggest opportunities? And really make a lot of early planning. You got to build relationships with maybe people who can get reliable election information onto your platform, such as the election authorities, whatever those geographies are. So we kind of looked at it and said 2024 is going to be big. Let's get our guidance out in 2023 so that people have, for the US election, a full year plus, for other things throughout the year, at least some time to start looking at this and hopefully leveraging it to do a better job.
We have the timeline. We have why it's important. What parts of the report do you think are the most helpful for folks, or what do you want to highlight and talk about?
Those of us who are putting this together, we have done this before, pretty consistently as a group of professionals who've done this before, which means we think we have something to share. But the first thing I'd say is I hope we've managed to share it usefully to folks. So please, my request is actually let us know where we're hitting and we're missing. Let us know what else you need if you're inside, one of these internet companies, large or small, whether you have questions that we're answering or questions that we aren't answering. And if you're one of the organizations outside in who's working with these companies, whether external fact-checking, whether civil society organizations who really want to, and by the way, thank you for putting the screws to companies sometimes to help keep their focus on things, whether you're elections authorities who can't figure out like, hey, I've got a problem with a thing and I have no idea how to let people know, you know, at a TikTok or a Discord or a Meta, you know, how to share accurate information. So like, so let us know how we're doing. So I don't want to presume that we've done the right thing. I will say then, with that caveat, I will say this is what we were thinking and what we've tried to provide. First and foremost, I think, and really going back to what we put out earlier this summer, what we wanted to share is just that this is not like, let's support the election or let's not support the election. The most important thing is like, you're going to have the election discussions happening. If you've got people talking to each other via some sort of platform, social media or otherwise on the internet, they're going to talk about what's important to them. And during election seasons in particular, that's a time of very heightened political awareness, political participation and discussion. It's going to happen, right? This is going to happen. And then the question is, okay, so, you know, if people are talking about elections, if people are potentially going to hear about things that are about how to vote or about, you know, the candidates, the issues, et cetera, you can look at it as what are your responsibilities as a platform, but you can also look at it as like, what are you trying to accomplish, right? Like maybe if you are really an entertainment venue or, you know, or something, maybe you don't feel like it's your responsibility to like push out a lot of news to your folks or to run voter registration drives. On the other hand, if you're like, no, actually, you know, we see ourselves in some of that role that maybe a lot of people have said that Twitter has been supplying over many years, where you know that that's kind of where people are coming to your platform to do. Maybe you want to make doubly sure that it's accurate. Maybe you do want to try and make that as participatory an experience as you can for everybody, right? So you got to figure out what goals to set. And that's the first thing. Understand what people are doing with your platform. Understand the environment of the election itself. Maybe what are the risks and what do you need to be concerned about, as well as what are the opportunities? You know, a lot of places you got to like register ahead to vote, like in the United States. So maybe voter registration really helps up political participation. It can really yield better outcomes and more civic engagement, right? And in other places, there's no pre-registration required. Everybody is expected to vote. So voter registration drive doesn't make any sense. But what might make more sense is understanding maybe there's a deep faith in the voting mechanisms, or maybe there isn't. Maybe there's reason to be deeply faithful of the voting. Maybe there's reasons to be concerned about whether the voting is going to be fair and accurately tallied, for example, right? Or whether if the vote is tallied, whether it's going to be respected or whether something's going to prevent the expressed will of the people from actually turning into governmental change, right? So understanding in each area, like what are the risks, what are the opportunities, and then setting specific goals for what you feel like as a platform you want to try and accomplish. Is your goal about misinformation control? Is your goal about, you know, making sure the information about risks in the actual process or how to participate in the process is accurately shared out? Are your goals just to try and avoid, you know, harassment and making it just a safe space to have political opinions online, right? And even a safe space to be a candidate, especially a candidate from a group of people who has historically been targeted, right? Like, is it safe for a female candidate to be on your platform and running for office in, I don't know, I don't want to pick a country and pick on that, but like, you know, even in the US, that's a concern, but in a lot of other places in the world, it's even more of a concern where I think that the expectations on roles are different, right? So, so, you know, these are the kinds of things where you got to set your goals, understand what's on your platform, and then figure out how to combine those two, right? Here's the environment of the world. Here's what's happening on my platform. Here's what I'd like to change about what's happening on my platform. Here's what I'd like to make better. And then can you measure that? Can you react to that as it changes through the dynamic election season?
Yeah, and I love that you have specific, like, both specific examples on some of the risks and opportunities. So we can get into that later. I know we have some other people who have a lot of discussion about risk, so we'll get into that. But also, you know, what do specific interventions look like? What might it look like for different groups of people? what is monitoring and metrics. So you run, you know, the whole spectrum of policy, operations, product, stakeholder management, outreach, like every part of the integrity ecosystem. So this isn't just a guide for, you know, specific people working in specific areas, but it's much more cross-functional, which I really appreciate.
Yeah, we tried to be cross-functional. We tried to also understand that not all companies are in the same situation. Like myself and several other people involved in this were at Meta, which is, you know, like the world's biggest social media company for better and for worse, right? Mm-hmm. Meta is an incredibly like metrics-driven, super numerically like intense and company, right? So like we spent a lot of time getting really detailed about, you know, metrics. And we also had just, let's be honest, a lot of people working for the company. Company made a lot of money, which allowed them to employ a lot of people. And so we had the ability to have all like these distinct teams. And so, you know, we would have operations teams in each country. We'd have national operations teams. We had these giant groups of people doing like content rating. We would have large product development teams working on all these different sorts of things, right? And so like that was one environment where you're going to go like a lot deeper in a smaller company. I've also worked in a number of companies that were less than 100 people, which is, you know, smaller than just, you know, the civic integrity team alone in, you know, product team inside of Facebook. So you got to figure out like what's realistic for you, and you got to work at the scale that you work at. I hope we've walked a line there to like let everybody know, like, here are the concerns, how deep you can go, how wide you can go. Those are hard trade-offs to make. I would advocate for everybody that you the clarity that you can get yourself about what your goals are, and the clarity you can find for yourself about whether you're actually moving towards those goals. Like, can you actually see the change on your platform that you're trying to make? Like, that's healthy for everybody, right? Because everything in this space is going to be dynamic. Every election is going to be a different shape. It's so hard to just like come up with like a single solution for metrics and just go with it, right? Like your risks are different. The people are different. The timing is different. You know, many people say this is going to be the election, you know, the first set of global AI elections, whatever that means. I don't know what it means, but we do know that it's going to be a lot more, content that's going to be partially or entirely created through non-human means in this cycle. So what does that mean? It means it can be different from everyone you've done before, and probably 2 years, 5 years on, it's going to be different in yet another way, right? It's always changing. So makes this work kind of exciting and interesting and hopefully rewarding, but it means that like it's really hard to even make those choices about like what are you going to do, and then to figure out like if you have a target, what do you have to do operationally? Is it practical? Are there ways you can change your product to reduce the amount of operational work you've got to do, right? Like if you got to be like, oh, I got to read everything that everybody writes on my platform and figure out if any of it is you know, hateful, good luck. I mean, you know, people are going to write this stuff faster than you can read it, or else you don't have a very successful internet platform, right? You know, that the economics of that don't work. So like, what can you do that, you know, makes it, helps people on your platform to be less hateful in the first place? You know, those are really important levers to pull.
I think that's really well said, and also easier to say then implement, which is why it's important so that people start thinking about it ahead of time.
Yeah, this is why you need to start early, and it's why some amount of metrics and monitoring so that you can see if you try something, is it doing what you want? It's really important. You got to have the policies so that you can do some moderation. You got to think about your product and think not just adversarial. There's a great collection in this latest guide about like a taxonomy of the different types of actors that can bring harm into your system, which is great. It's not social media specific. It's sort of like just a way to think about and maybe input into red teaming if you're prepared to do some red teaming, and think about like if I was an adversarial actor and I really had this antisocial goal of some type, whether it's to defraud people, whether it's to, you know, to create political chaos, whatever it might be, you know, how would I go about it? How could I leverage your platform in a way that you may not have wanted it to be leveraged? But so that's all very important, but a lot of it isn't even adversarial. A lot of it is people who are just, you know, trying to live their lives and do the things and communicate with other humans. And sometimes the way they do that isn't set out to create harm, but is going to be a much less effective than other types of communication, and your platform can you know, end up creating some sort of negative feedback cycles or perpetuating a lot of bias in that, even, you know, apart from moderation concerns. Elections are times with very real consequences for humans in so many different ways. You know, who's going to run the country? Who's going to be chased out of town? Will there be violence? Will people be willing to talk to each other afterwards, even if they voted for different people, right? Like, that matters. Like, if we can't talk to each other, even though we voted for different people, it becomes pretty hard to continue to run your country. So like, all these things are very real problems. And given that, especially for the people who are involved, the people who are running for office, the people who are in political positions of power and are trying to be in positions of power, right? This is important stuff to them. They're going to pull out the stops. They're going to do the things that they can do to try and do what they need for themselves and or that they believe are right. So it's going to be it's always a little bit gloves off.
I think that's a great, maybe not a great sentiment, but an appropriate statement to end on. But is there anything else that you want to highlight or add?
Yeah, I hope that people in platforms find this helpful. I hope that other people get a little window into what people inside the platforms are dealing with and the trade-offs that can be so tough, the different ways that this is all very complicated. But even if it's complicated, it's incredibly important. So good luck to us all.
Good luck to us all indeed. And thanks for talking with me.
Oh, thank you for having this conversation. It's fantastic. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Diane Chang. I am a former product manager at Meta. I led our civic integrity product strategy, a civic incubation team, as well as some of our crisis response product efforts between 2021 and earlier this year in 2023.
How did you contribute to this giant, amazing election report with the Integrity Institute? What was your role in that?
Yeah, I helped flesh out some of the sections on the various types of product interventions, the impossible trade-offs, and just added in various points throughout the various sections, including measurement. But those two, I would call it as my top favorite sections.
I think the impossible trade-off section was my favorite part of the whole thing. It was so interesting. Like, it's nice to see tips and best practices and other things, but to really have a case study of something that is impossible really helps to show the complexity of this kind of work and how nuanced and difficult it is. Did you have a favorite impossible trade-off?
I think just in general, what I'm sure people experience time and again is that your goals will inevitably come into conflict with other competing principles or business concerns. That's, you know, a lot of, I think, the crux of what makes a lot of trust and safety efforts in any kind of company really challenging. So I hope we, you know, helped people provide some guidelines or at least some frameworks to think about how to navigate this.
Is there any one specific thing that you hope that people come away from the report knowing?
Yeah, I know that a lot of times when you're trying to put this into action and you are facing an election, the stakes feel so high and it could be really scary to consider that there are consequences to any given choice that you make. But a lot of times, realistically, there is no perfect answer, or maybe there is not even a right or a best answer. You ultimately have to, you know, operate with the best information you have available to you, really make sure you've thoroughly vetted the trade-offs, are prepared to handle whatever blowback may happen or whatever downside may result, and move forward the best you can, knowing that, you know, there's limited information, there's often no counterfactual, and these are very complex situations. So I hope this is reassuring to people that you are doing your best and there's no perfect, and that is okay.
Whether you're working in elections or not, if you're anywhere involved with integrity or trust and safety, that's a message that people need to hear over and over again. So
absolutely.
Thank you for saying that.
Thanks.
You already talked about some of the things that you're proud of or wanted to talk about, but is there anything that really stands out?
I also really love the product interventions section. I think this was really helpful to gather a number of examples of existing products that exist from a number of platforms that we used here as examples. These are ones that have been publicly shared by the companies in various forums, but it's really cool to see them pulled together. And I hope this serves as at least a starting point and some inspiration for other platforms, because the specific mechanics of their platform will likely be different from like a Twitter or a Facebook app, but this kind of shows the various categories of interventions. And this is really just a small subset of all the ways that companies can think about the actual product design aspect of intervening on these really challenging problems. So I am actually excited to see how people who are trying to take from this, draw inspiration, might actually either try out their equivalent of these type of features, or maybe this could jog some more innovative new ways to come up with new election integrity features and hear from them on what that's like, how it goes for them and what inspiration comes of this.
I hope so, but we don't have too much time until the great 2024. So.
I know. A year lead time gives you pretty good, if you could like do some brainstorming, rapidly test within a 6 month increment. I think that gives you a good sense of what will start to look like it works, what doesn't, and then really prepare that to be in production and ready by the time we get deeper into the primary season. I think a year is pretty good lead time if you're prioritizing it now.
And that's the message I think of this whole report is now is the time to start thinking about it.
Absolutely. I'm really interested in hearing how it goes for people that might take from this guide and look to implement it on their platform, wherever they are, especially folks that work at, you know, newer or slightly smaller companies with newer platforms. I'd love to know what works, what doesn't. Do we make some big assumptions here? Or is this actually useful to you? How could it be better? Any kind of feedback there would be really incredibly helpful, because I think the feedback we've gotten initially is so many of these sections could be their own guide. And so would love to know how we could iterate and provide additional support if needed.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for doing this, Alice.
So my name is Swapnil Mehta. I'm a postdoc at Boston University and research affiliate at MIT. I study platform governance, and I recently graduated with my PhD from NYU in data science, studying social media and politics, in particular platform interventions and how they actually affect the flow of information online.
What part of this report did you work on?
So I contributed primarily to the threat actor side of things, and then a secondary contribution was on the platform interventions side. I think when I come into teams working on this, they bring a lot of industry experience into this sort of report writing, while I try to bring in the research side of things and cite examples or cite relevant frameworks to actually use that might inform better decision making as things devolve into a wild west of sorts with generative AI changing the nature of information online, changing the ways we approach content moderation just because content moderation can no longer be about content alone. I don't think it ever was the case, but we just used to think or rely a lot more on keyword-driven approaches than we can do currently. So in that sense, I try to contribute the threat actor side with Eric Davis. I worked on creating a set of groups of actors that we want to understand better in terms of their goals, the tactics they use, and the kind of agenda we've seen them exhibit in the past. So the threat actors include like hacktivist groups ranging from hacktivist groups to foreign adversaries to just regular users who get pulled into the ecosystem sharing and promoting certain trends and narratives, to financially motivated, politically motivated, economically motivated actors, each of whom has a specific set of agendas. And the way we boil this down is from the bottom-up approach, where we try to pull up anecdotes of what we actually saw happen to platforms and use those to inform this framework building in terms of who constitutes a threat actor and why we want to care about certain tactics they exhibit. The answer to which is almost always that this repeats in different demographies, in different contexts. No matter what platform policies come about, these actors find a way to get around them, and we should have a better prior understanding. Especially if you're a new platform, you should know what has failed and succeeded in the past so that you can build your own strategies on top of that instead of reinventing the wheel.
That makes total sense. Do you have a favorite anecdote or cautionary tale?
I think one of the anecdotes that I would look to is really old, but really relevant, the Pizzagate controversy, where a certain, I mean, there were many groups that promoted this narrative of there is this pizza parlor in DC that runs a child or human trafficking ring out of the basement. And it went on to the scale of people actually holding physical protests, groups, meetups around this whole controversy. And eventually, one of the people who really believed in all of this went up, drove about 400 miles, I think from North Carolina to DC, and shot up the doors of the pizza parlor. Now, no one got hurt in this process, but that was purely by a stroke of luck, I would say. Like, it's very easy to think of 100 different ways this could have gone wrong, and this could have ended up badly, primarily because it has happened before in different cases. So this, based purely on an internet rumor promoted by different groups of actors, can lead to tangible harms if not mitigated during the process. And this has repeated in different manners across different platforms. So it's really a wild example of how things can go wrong, especially during elections. And now I believe they have a movie about this. They have some sort of TV shows about this as well. But it's just a very prevalent example of how online harms manifest.
Yeah, and that's an example of people who you wouldn't necessarily think of as being a threat actor, or who wouldn't think of themselves as being threat actors because they're normal citizens who believe what they see on the internet.
And this fits in very well with the intervention side of things that we describe in the deck. So Glenn led this effort, and I sort of lightly edited certain sections and added in relevant examples. But the idea of platforms taking on interventions is for them to create these stopgap solutions for the time being while they figure out deeper systemic changes that they can make to reduce the incentives for the spread of low quality news or misinformation on the platform. With the caveat that defining misinformation in the first place is a really hard challenge in and of itself. But certain times in elections, you have the support of fact checkers. You can identify things that are clearly false narratives, and at least stopping that minority of cases where you know things are inaccurate or accurate with a high degree of confidence is really important. So with respect to interventions, we tried to look at different kinds of examples, right from warning labels up to algorithmic changes that would be possible. Although I don't know if that made it to the final cut of the deck, but the idea was try to create examples that platforms can apply of interventions and think about them again in a more systemic manner, where you can learn from past examples of the same platforms applying the same interventions in a different context. So Facebook had downranking once upon a time, and they made things explicit in the sense where if we find groups that are recidivist actors or like repeatedly share platform policy violating content, we will downrank the posts that you have. And there was some interesting research around this that people did that discovered that there was a change in behavior as a result of these kinds of interventions. As for myself, I also participated in research that's soon to be coming out, but I presented this at Stanford last year, so I can actually talk about it. It's about identifying how warning labels on Twitter applied to former President Donald Trump's tweets actually had causal effects that if you look at one slice of it, it contributed to an increase in engagement. But if you look at other slices of it, even off the platform, so on Twitter, it might have contributed to increasing engagement, but off platform, it actually contributed to a reduction in the number of posts that were spreading about Trump's tweets. So it's also the fact that you need to look at interventions in a broader context, and these kinds of decks that place all of these interventions sequentially in a certain one-stop shop for interventions would be helpful for platforms to think about this more systematically.
That's a great example. Is there anything else that you want to highlight from the work that you did, or from even work that other people did in the deck that you think is really important or interesting?
I think I like the idea of escalation pathways, because it's often the case that escalation pathways involve non-platform actors. They either involve someone else doing the reporting, or they involve platforms going to the government to ask for some changes in, especially in an elections context, you need to be in touch with the local election authorities to monitor any upcoming changes, trends, narratives that might allow you to develop a better understanding of the information environment. And Escalation Pathways does a decent job of listing out, here are the ways in which you want to go about this. And I think Katie also added a section about, here are the actual actors or like the agencies that you as a platform that has a lot of users will need to be in touch with to understand who to go to when shit hits the fan.
Definitely important. Well, thank you so much.
Likewise, thank you for doing this. Appreciate it.
Next up is Eric Davis. Unfortunately, he had a bit of mic trouble at the beginning, so we missed him introducing himself, but here he is.
Yeah, so I have a multifaceted background, all relating to areas of trust and safety, integrity, security, privacy. My focus areas include democratic, small d integrity, ecosystem security, improving ecosystem security, and protecting vulnerable populations.
Which is such important work. So what part of the report did you work on, and where should we get started in talking about that?
Yeah, so I worked on two areas, the actor taxonomy, where I partnered with Swapneel, and the issue of artificial intelligence being used maliciously in elections. It's intended to be kind of a primer on different types of issues relating to the misuse of AI tools and how they manifest on the platform how to think about it and different approaches to dealing with it. You know, artificial intelligence has been around for a long time, and it is very much a neutral tool. It's become a concern because it's better, stronger, and faster than anything else that's been out there. Generative AI, for all its benefits, it can also be used to make deceptively authentic content. So you're looking and that image or you're looking at or audio file you're listening to or the video file, a deepfake is when it, let's say the video file doesn't mean what you think it means. And actually, when you look at kind of the history of media manipulation, the altered photos, are almost as old as the invention of the photo. Generative AI, and of course, very prominently with ChatGPT, has made that technology much more accessible to a broad audience and much more available. Deepfakes are often referred to as synthetic media. Deepfakes have been used in election campaigns, both in the United States and globally. The use is much more pronounced globally. The real or one of the primary deepfake scenarios that that I'm concerned about, the kind that that were used in the Chicago mayoral race, where I think it was a day before the election, a deepfake of one of the candidates was circulated of him saying problematic things, the police and racist and so forth, defamatory, put out at a time where there's not enough time for campaigns to deal with it, authenticate it. It didn't come through official channels. And that person lost the race. Now, there could be any number of factors, right? I mean, we got causation and correlation. Globally, elections in Slovakia, where there are similar issues, in this case, there were audio deepfakes. And what's convenient for audio deepfakes is it's harder to, as a typical user, instantly decide that whether or not it's fake, because in audio, that tends to be low quality to begin with. I think the use cases we're seeing outside the United States, I see them as kind of canaries. For what we have up ahead. although, you know, I just spent all this time talking about concerns with AI, you know, as I said, they're also, they didn't invent the problem of hit pieces in politics. Platforms should treat the issue of deepfakes and related manipulative AI very seriously, but they shouldn't limit their policies to that. And as an example, there was a recent Meta Oversight Board case where there was a video of President Biden that was manipulated, and it wasn't done with AI tech, and so therefore they didn't take it down. And so again, you know, AI is obviously an issue, but platforms should be clear about how they're approaching this in terms of, okay, these are our rules for synthetic or manipulated media, and that, you know, absolutely should include content that's produced by AI, and there are qualities to that that should be considered in dealing with it, but it also applies to these other areas. Platforms should think about how they'll distinguish, you know, again, a materially deceptive media from a parody. Materially deceptive is just, I think it's a great term, and it has a long history in case law, the SEC, the FTC, consumer protection. And there's all sorts of tools for defining that. And in terms of how a reasonable person reacts to media. So there's the overall policy, like how we're going to scope this out. What are we going to do about it? Are we going to require everybody labels all AI produced content? So for example, TikTok is doing that, and that's a great step forward. Google's ad policies require disclosure about this as well. Our classification models for detecting deepfakes in general, you know, that technology is going to keep changing over time. It's going to become more and more difficult. But when it comes to the issue of detecting fake content, and that includes text as well, a lot of the old rules don't apply as easily. So if you're a low budget influence operation, I mean, like the stuff that Russia tried to do in previous elections, they didn't have a big budget. And, you know, often text would be repeated in multiple platforms. And researchers, I think they refer to it as spaghetti text. Like you can see the same phrasing used, you know, 15 different typical places. Using generative AI, the text is distinct. And there are other hallmarks, like it's much better written. And we're going to see this as well more and more, let's say, with phishing and catfishing attacks, where, you know, you can tell almost instantly, you know, the person's kind of cultural awareness, you know, in terms of like even pop culture, that, you know, they don't actually live down the street from you, so to speak. AI, because of the risks that it represents, cautiously proactive about this. And I should underscore, like Katie Harbeth has, her expression is panic responsibly, right?
I love it, yeah.
Yeah, which I think perfectly applies to dealing with the problem of AI. Now there's Europe is finishing up development and approval of an AI bill. In June, there were some sections added relating to the use of AI in elections. You know, there's legislation sort of moving through Congress. There's state legislation that's been passed, different places like California. They're all good faith efforts. They're all kind of lacking in some critical areas where, and again, this kind of goes back to platform policy. They focus too much on the technology rather than the problem that they're trying to solve. There's also the issue, you know, we've been talking about this in terms of elections, but we really need to think about it as in terms of campaigns and elections. And by campaigns, there's obviously campaigning for office, but, you know, there are always official or unofficial campaigns going on to influence policy decisions in government operations. Vote yes, we want an elected official to vote for or against the bill. There are also influence campaigns, let's say foreign influence campaigns. Most of the legislation I've seen has guidelines set to the proximity of the election, and that could be within 30 days of an election, 60, 90, and so forth. But we need to think about everything that happens in between. And I mean, it's, again, there's a lot to be done. We also don't want to overreach. But another area that legislators should be exploring is the problem of botnets used to impersonate people. And so, of course, there are all the cases of the bots posting things on Twitter. We're starting to see, not a lot yet, but we're starting to see instances of botnets that can that are working pretty well with generative AI technology. So again, it's AI is working here, generative AI as a force multiplier. There's the new legislation. There's also existing legislation which could be tweaked. A lot of that having to do, for example, with computer crimes, let's say. There are some laws against impersonation. They're not quite explicit or broad or targeted enough to clearly apply to deepfakes. Basically non-consensual representation in media. And that, of course, can address a lot of other issues that we're seeing.
Amazing. Eric, you had so much to share. I appreciate it. I can tell you're really passionate about this and very knowledgeable, and so much background and specific examples, which are really, really helpful. So thank you very much.
Hopefully, you're very welcome. I really appreciate what you're doing. Not just this, but, the podcast in general. Have a great weekend.
Yeah, you too. Happy Friday.
Thanks. Care.
If you enjoyed this conversation, please share this episode with your friends. It helps us continue making more episodes for you. I'm Alice Hunsberger. Music by Zhao Shan. Special thanks to everyone at the Integrity Institute for their continued support.